Today's show is brought to you by Underbrush, a new thriller by Kevin Carr. There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. Only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Greetings, couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. This week, I'm going to be talking about The Hunger Games, Mockingjay Part 2, The Night Before, Secret in Their Eyes, Spotlight, and The Hollow. I'll also have a listener voicemail, some news, the trailer park, the box office predictions, and of course, the world-famous home cinema roundup. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And you can reach out to me on Twitter at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
The first piece of news is a little bit of inside baseball, something that Jesse Eisenberg wrote in The New Yorker that's kind of got some critics a little irked. And I'm not talking about critics like, you know, the real big one. Who are the big ones now, anyways? I mean, Roger Ebert is gone. David Anson from Newsweek is gone. Rex Reed is a dinosaur. So I guess a lot of the big critics, even though you might want to see somebody from Variety or The Hollywood Reporter, but he's lashing out at internet critics, I think, a lot of them. And it's a satirical piece written from the point of view of a film critic. You can go on The New Yorker and find it. And it essentially accuses film critics of, by straw man argument, of just being these intellectual nobodies who have no life and are crushing on the publicists who are arranging these screenings, and how they're pretentious little jerks who write what people want them to write. And I really don't care, mainly because I think that when you get to the point that you start to answer to your critics, you are no longer relevant. You know, like, I remember Michael Bay. I don't like Michael Bay, but I remember Michael Bay lashed out at critics for being too harsh on him. And I remember thinking, oh no, Michael Bay, you know, part of your power was that you didn't care what the critics have to say. But when you lash out at critics, that shows you do care what they have to say. And that lessens you as an actor or director, and it doesn't make you look as with it. And while some people took this personally, I didn't. But the one thing that did bother me is that it was such an old argument. I mean, didn't we have this whole discussion with that Shia LaBeouf plagiarism piece, that Howard Cantor, where Jim Gaffigan was playing a pretentious film critic with no life and no real career? And I know artists are like, oh, you're out there destroying people. But, you know, Eisenberg, I know you've written satirical pieces in the past, but this just makes you look petty. That's my critical review of his piece. I think it's just silly because it had the intended effect on people, but you have to look at it and say, Jesse Eisenberg, you're like an Academy Award nominated actor and you're lashing out at internet critics. The next piece of news is, I don't actually follow UFC fighting, but I did follow a little bit of the Ronda Rousey Holly Holm fight from last weekend. And the only reason I did is because there's so many people on my Twitter timeline and Facebook timeline that did. She got her butt handed to her by Holly Holm. Now, I don't know anything about Holly Holm, but I'm getting tired of Ronda Rousey, mainly because people are treating Ronda Rousey as the greatest athlete ever. Well, not after last week's fight, because she got her butt handed to her. I mean, in the second round, she was knocked out. Now, she was knocked out because Holly Holm saw her stumble and took advantage of it. But that's how UFC works. And maybe now we can stop putting her in action movies, because she really is a terrible actor. I don't know. She may be a great fighter. She may be the greatest fighter that ever lived. But when it comes to being an actor, she's awful. And that's my full-fledged Jesse Eisenberg-tainted opinion of that. The last piece of news that I want to hit on is Mystery Science Theater 3000, which is one of my favorite shows of all time. We talked a little bit about them last week because they're bringing the show back. Now, they reached their first goal in Kickstarter of $2 million. So it is going to come back. There are going to be three new episodes, and they've announced the new host, which, I mean, I get that they're not going to use the same old group. That's the only thing that I've, like I said last week, that I had just concerns about, is that it wasn't going to be the same MST. But, you know, that's great. You know, put something new together. I mean, it's been, what, 15 years or so since it's even been on the air? And it's been like 20 years since Joel's been involved. So, you know, good for them. But one of the things that Joel Hutchinson's doing in concert with Shout Factory, which now distributes all the Mystery Science Theater's DVDs, is they are going to be doing a Turkey Day. On the internet, it's not going to be on like Comedy Central or the Sci-Fi Channel, which is where it used to be. I don't even know if it was ever on the Sci-Fi Channel. But they're doing Turkey Day, which back in the day, back in the early 90s, Turkey Day was the big thing for people like me, fans of Mystery Science Theater. They would run 30 hours of the show because each show is 2 hours because it, you know, it had a movie in it. And last year they brought back Turkey Day and they streamed them over the internet for, I think, 12 hours. This year they're doing it again for 12 hours. It's going to be 6 episodes starting at noon on Thanksgiving. And it's going to be streamed on the internet with new introductions by Joel. And I think that's great. I love seeing MST3K come back because it did sort of disappear there for a while. And it's one of my favorite shows of all time. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. Let's talk about Zoolander 2. That got a new trailer this week, and it's opening February 12th.
Derek Zoolander, I'm with Interpol. I need your help.
She's hot. I trust her.
Someone's trying to kill the world's most beautiful people.
Oh, fudge!
Peace out, world.
All of them died with your signature look. This is blue steel, right? We need you to infiltrate the world of high fashion.
We're back!
First of all, I'm going to just predict this isn't going to be as good as Zoolander. I loved Zoolander, but this is a sequel, and it's a sequel that's, what, 15 years late. But it looks like they're having a little bit of fun with it. They're kowtowing a bit to the fans, and they are doing some service there, and they are bringing a lot of the characters back. But it looks fun. It looks a bit Austin Powers-ish to me, which is good, because that's kind of what Zoolander's always been. Zoolander's been that absurd, over-the-top, ridiculous nature, and I love the original Zoolander. I also love the fact that Ben Stiller is also directing it again, because I think he's a fantastic director. I would say Ben Stiller's a better director at times than he is even an actor. And I think he's a good actor, a good, not just a good dramatic actor, but a good comedic actor. His last movie was The Secret Life of Walter Mitty, which was a fantastic film that got underseen and underappreciated. The next trailer I want to talk about is Gods of Egypt, and that one opens on April 8th.
Set has taken over Egypt and enslaved its people. One god can save us, but not without his eyes.
Steal from a god.
I have something set up for me. We need your help.
Soon we will rule the world.
Now, and they just had Exodus Gods and Kings come out almost about a year ago. This one is directed by Alex Proyas, who did the original Crow, and he did Dark City, which I love Dark City. It's not like Exodus, which was trying to do sort of this more realistic version of the Moses story. This one is a little bit more like Immortals or Clash of the Titans, so they got real gods working in this. But the one complaint I've been seeing is people are saying, oh, it's been whitewashed because it's got Gerard Butler as one of the pharaohs or one of the kings. And I get it. I get the complaint about whitewashing in Hollywood. And I think at times it's silly. But the first thing is Hollywood has a long history of having white guys play the Egyptians. All these things take place in the Middle East, and there's been white people playing them since the beginning of time. I also don't think that in a lot of instances people care about whitewashing. A lot of people I know lashed out at Pan because they cast Rooney Mara as Tiger Lily. But I'm like, Pan didn't bomb because it had a white girl playing Tiger Lily. Pan bombed because it just didn't click with anybody and it had no movie star outside of Hugh Jackman, who isn't a movie star outside of a film that doesn't have Wolverine claws on it. So whitewashing in Hollywood, first of all, it's the way things have always been. Now, I mean, if you did a movie about Martin Luther King and you had a white guy playing Martin Luther King, yeah, people are going to notice. That's going to seem absurd. But put somebody in the right outfit, and they're going to be playing somebody from thousands of years ago, and I don't think anyone's going to care. So if Gods of Egypt doesn't do well, it's not going to do well because it was whitewashed. It's just not going to do well because it looks ridiculously cheesy. That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to jump into the movie reviews with Secret in Their Eyes and Spotlight. Because we can! There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kuykendall Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies, starting off with the movie reviews. We're not going to hit the big one yet. Let's hit with the smaller one that's actually kind of flying in, probably under a lot of people's radar, and although it's getting a lot of promotion out there, and it's got some great stars in it, and that is Secret in Their Eyes. This remake of an Argentine crime thriller sees authorities trying to decide whether to pursue the murderer of one of their daughters or keep the killer safe as a mole in a terrorist cell.
LAPD just found an unidentified female body in a garage dumpster.
What is it?
It's Carol. It's your daughter.
What?
This is the guy.
Death penalty. That'd be too good for him.
That guy. I can't have you question him.
You're letting him go, aren't you?
I'm sorry.
He's guilty. We can't just let him walk.
We're gonna get him. No matter what it takes.
I know people who've seen the original. I've not seen it. But I know people who have said it's a fantastic movie. And the problem whenever you adapt a really fantastic movie into an American film or English language remake, it's oftentimes not as good. So I can't say whether it's as good as the original, but I'll tell you this, it still works as a thriller. It is very deliberately giving a lot of acting moments to, in particular, Julia Roberts, who does fine in the role. She does well. And it's definitely a spotlight on her performance. But it's also got some great performances by Chiwetel Ejiofor. It's got a pretty decent performance by Nicole Kidman and Alfred Molina. So they've got a lot of good people involved in this film. And maybe it's because it originated as an Argentine Spanish language thriller. It doesn't quite feel as Hollywood as those Ashley Judd, Morgan Freeman thrillers that we saw in the 90s. Where he was playing Alex Cross in a very non-Alex Cross sort of way. This one feels like a grown-up movie. It's the kind of movie that, you know, your parents would go see on date night or that they would rent as opposed to the big blockbuster, you know, Avengers movie or something like that. It does put you in a position of what would you do? And I think the subject matter is interesting, especially in light of recent world events, because it's dealing with terrorism and it's dealing with the greater good, because that's the big question. Yes, this guy probably raped and murdered your daughter, but he can give us a lot of information that can save hundreds of lives, maybe thousands of lives. So do we want to take him off the street? And it poses those personal, very personal feelings of loss and regret and guilt and anger and puts them up against the greater good, which is always an interesting thing to contemplate in any sort of wartime, whether it's a hot war, like, you know, on the battlefield, or if it's more of a cold war, because, you know, the war on terror is very much a cold war. It's not raging on the shores right now. It's not like the cold war of the Russian and U.S. History, but it is somewhat of a cold war where things are happening, but you're not necessarily getting that overbearing, direct, coordinated attacks of armies. It's a very different type of war. I enjoyed Secret in Their Eyes. It was predictable. I pretty much guessed everything. I feel like such a jerk when I say that, but that's the way I'm. I see hundreds of movies a year, new and old. But I mean, I see between 500 and 600 movies over the course of every year. I've watched a lot of films. So when a movie like this comes along, I can usually predict what's going to happen. And because I mean, they're looking at it saying, well, it's either going to be this, which is so painfully predictable, it's shameful, or it's going to do this little clever thing. And I end up predicting that it did this little clever thing because it's the only option other than the really painfully predictable mundane version. But overall, I think Secret in Their Eyes is it's a decent movie. It's just worth checking out, and it's flying completely under the radar, I think, for most people, because Mockingjay's the big film. But it's actually probably the better movie. So Secret in Their Eyes kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Spotlight. This docudrama tells the story of the Boston Globe's investigation into the sexual abuse scandal within the Catholic Church.
The Boston priests molested kids in 6 different parishes over the last 30 years. The church found out about it and did nothing.
We haven't committed any long-term investigative resources to the case.
No, we haven't.
And that's the kind of thing your team would do.
Spotlight?
Obviously, the church will fight us very hard.
When you're a poor kid from a poor family, and when a priest pays attention to you, it's a big deal.
Spotlight.
Just the tip line.
You think he's got something?
I want to keep digging.
We need to focus on the institution. Show me that it came from the top down.
Like anybody, I remember when this broke, and it was a heartbreaking, horrifying thing that had marred the Catholic Church and will mar the Catholic Church for years to come. What's funny is both Secret in Their Eyes and Spotlight have these, well, Secret in Their Eyes bounces back and forth between modern day and like 2002, 2003-ish. Spotlight takes place right around 2001. And they actually, of course, have to address 9/11 happening in this movie because that's when it happened and it's a true story. It's weird watching these movies that are flashing back to the early 2000s, because to me, I'm thinking, well, that's not very long ago. And then I realize it's 13, 14, 15 years ago. And then I realize that I'm an old fart and this is now history. It's not recent events. This is history. But the framework of it is like an old school newspaper investigative reporting film. Something like All the President's Men, although it deals with a very different subject. And what's different in that is in All the President's Men, you had the giant newsroom where they're in. And they show, you see the Boston newsroom, but it's Spotlight, which is the smaller magazine that was doing the investigative reporting, which is off on the newsroom. And it's this small little office of a handful of desks. So it's sort of that teeny tiny newsroom, but it's got fantastic performances. I mean, you got Michael Keaton, John Slattery, Liev Schreiber, Mark Ruffalo is particularly good in this, Stanley Tucci, Rachel McAdams. They've got a lot of great names in this film. And I was talking to somebody on the radio this week in an interview, and they kind of essentially said, well, this was a bit of a hit piece on religion. I'm like, no, it really isn't. Yeah, the Catholic Church, which is a religious organization, came under great fire, rightfully so, for the shenanigans that were going on here. This is not an anti-religious movie. This is a pro-First Amendment movie. This is a pro-investigation movie. This is a movie that says, hey, look, if somebody's doing something this heinous and wrong, you got to go after them. You can't hide this. You know, just recently, Jared Fogle from Subway was sentenced to, 15 years? We need more of that. If you're going to go out there and victimize people like this, you need to be punished. You should not be swept under the rug. And Spotlight, while it does give a sympathetic look to the news team, this is something that needed to come to light. This is not something that needed to be buried. And I don't think that this is a hit on religion. It's a hit on power. It's a hit on people using power to protect evil people. And it doesn't canonize, no pun intended, the investigative staff, but it shows what they went through and what they had to look at. And it shows how hard it was to dismantle this. It's a riveting movie. It's not necessarily a lickety-split, fast-paced film. And it's one of the last ones you're ever going to see of how the inner workings of an investigative journalism team works. And better than Truth. I liked Truth. But this is that old-school newspaper. Now, newspapers are going the way of the dodo, thanks to the internet. So the investigative practices are very different. But it's a really well-done movie and a necessary movie to make, especially because now, again, this is history. This isn't recent past. It's stuff that we got to remember that even in the nicest of places, you can get some really horrible things happening. So I'm going to say Spotlight totally rocks. Watch this one through award season.
It rocks.
Excellent.
That's it for the segment. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about The Hunger Games, Mockingjay Part 2, and The Night Before. Kevin Carr's new horror anthology, 13 Turns, brings you a series of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, and classic gothic horror. A man is trapped, forced to murder himself every day of his unnatural life.
Necromancers resurrect two famous figures from history for sport. A beautiful day in an amusement park turns into a murder investigation after a mysterious death on a roller coaster. A researcher in an abandoned prison discovers a portal to another dimension. 13 Turns by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited.
Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies. Continuing the film reviews, let's talk about The Hunger Games: Mockingjay Part Dos. The final chapter of the Hunger Games saga tells the end of the last book, finally.
We all have one enemy. And that's President Snow. Stop killing for him. Tonight, turn your weapons to the Capitol. Turn your weapons to Snow.
What happened with the Hunger Games, as just Hollywood getting its claws on it, to me is one of the saddest things that's ever happened to a movie franchise ever. It's one thing when they split the final book in the Twilight Saga, because I had a radio host point that out to me. But it was a Twilight movie. So I didn't care about preserving the story because it was a crappy story anyways with terrible characters. And the worst part about it, them splitting the Twilight movie into two, was you ended up with two Twilight movies. So I had to sit through an extra one. Now, when they did Harry Potter and they split that into two, it was okay for me because they'd already had six movies. And that book was dense. It was thick, had a natural breaking point. And I still think they could have done a single Harry Potter movie, made it like a 3-hour finale. It wasn't necessary, but I thought that at least the gravitas of the series could handle it. And it was still well done. And the lesser of the two in terms of the Harry Potter movies was Deathly Hallows Part 1 versus Part 2. They split The Hobbit, and I like The Hobbit movies. I tend to like them. I'm very forgiving of those. But I'll be the first to admit that, like, Desolation of Smaug is just a bridge movie. There's no plot to it in any sort of traditional sense. There is no overreaching character arc. The Hobbit films could have been a 1 3-hour movie. There's some that I'm like, enjoy more than others, but on principle, the idea of splitting a book into two movies just to get more cash, I think is not a good way to do it unless all you care about is money. But I think that that's going to get run into the ground. They're splitting the last Divergent book into two, and I think that's going to be an absolute failure. I think that Divergent, it just doesn't have the mainstream audience. So while Hunger Games is huge, and you're still going to have people being a completist and seeing all the movies, the Divergent films, there was a dip from the first one to the second one, and they're not doing as well. So I think they're just going to run out of steam. And you start releasing movies that are half stories, people are going to care about them. So unless it has some massive push behind it like The Hunger Games did, I think that audiences eventually are going to get very quickly tired of this. So I didn't like the idea that they split that up. And the first two films in The Hunger Games series I thought were actually really pretty good. They had some smart stuff happening in it. They were building a world, and it was effective and interesting. The third movie, which was the first part of Mockingjay, felt like half a movie. It was half a story, which is exactly what it was. It doesn't resolve itself at all. It just sets itself up for like a final act. In the process, in order to make that movie not just 1 hour long, they had to pad it out with a bunch of unnecessary nonsense. Like the scene of her singing by the lake and all the dream sequences. Just a lot of talking that doesn't need to be in the movie. This film is just as bad, if not worse. And the reason for that is the first hour and a half of this movie, you don't need. The first hour and a half of this movie is just a bunch of people talking. Then they start like going through the Capitol. And yeah, this is where they put the action sequences in. That's where they're, you know, justifying the amount of money they're spending on this. But it sort of reminds me of, if you remember the Polar Express, because they show it every year at Christmas. This is a movie that was based on a 12-page children's book or something. And the Polar Express, while it was neat to watch because it was mocap and it was CGI, and it's a sweet little Christmas story, all the cool things that happen in the Polar Express has nothing that impacts the ending of the film. Like when they get into Santa's workshop, it's just they go into Santa's workshop, they see some cool stuff, and they get back on the track. When the train almost skids off the tracks on the ice, it's just it kind of does that, and it comes back, and it doesn't impact the story at all. Looks cool, but it has no impact on the story. And that's exactly what you see with The Hunger Games: Mockingjay Part 2. It's padding. And the first hour and a half is like boring. I mean, borderlining on boring and stupid, because it's like a Felicity episode. You know, it's when Gail walks in and has to talk to Katniss, and then, oh, yeah, hi. Oh, well, you know, PETA's not doing well. And it's all this stuff that's recapping. It feels like a soap opera. When they finally get to that last half hour, there's some interesting stuff happening. I don't think it's as smart as the other movies are. I think that Suzanne Collins thought she was being more clever than she really was. She wasn't able to deliver a final oomph to the movie. And that was somewhat anticlimactic at times. And then it has this ending sequence that's like Return of the King that just keeps going, and it fades out and comes up to a new thing. Fades out, comes up to a new thing. And they do that a lot with movies that are supposedly these sagas because they want to tie up all the characters. But generally, you know, when with a book, you can do that. When a movie, once you have the climax and the action's over and the film's done, get out of there. You can have one scene of resolution, but you're going to overstay your welcome very quickly. And this movie does. It ends up not being a very good film. If you were to take the first part of this, cut out about 45 minutes, and then take the last half hour of this movie and throw it in there, you'd actually have a pretty good finale, a pretty good final movie, but you had to wait a year for it. And by the time anything gets resolved in this film, you're kind of like, that's what I waited a year for and spent more money on to see. Fans are going to love it. Yeah, if you like The Hunger Games, and you're, I mean, my wife's a big fan. She's going to love it. But, you know, aside from that, it's a good thing there's not going to be another one of these, because nobody would care. But I'm going to have to say Hunger Games: Mockingjay Part 2 kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about The Night Before. Like last week, we had a Christmas movie. We got another Christmas movie. It's not even Thanksgiving yet, and we've already got Christmas movies out. But, you know, no one wants to compete with Star Wars unless you're Tina Fey. In The Night Before, Seth Rogen, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, and Anthony Mackie play close friends who go out and party like crazy on Christmas Eve.
Gentlemen, 14 years ago to this very night,
I lost my parents.
You guys have been with me every single Christmas since then. But tonight, we have decided to end this tradition. Chris is just too famous to hang out with us anymore. And Isaac's about to have a baby.
Christmas. I have a present for you.
We're going to the best Christmas party in New York City. So that gives us several hours to hit as many traditions as possible.
Christmas is to the end of an era.
I think the cocaine and the mushrooms are reacting poorly.
Essentially, it's just a all-night party film. There are some of these movies that show up like Superbad, where it's just the all-night party movie. And it's raucous entertainment, the people being obnoxious and crazy, taking a bunch of drugs and getting drunk, getting into a bunch of shenanigans. And if that's all you want, that you're going to get that. That's really all this is. This is an all-night debauchery film, which I guess is okay for what it is, but it could have been better. Jonathan Levine, who did 50-50, which Rogan and Joseph Gordon-Levitt were both in, was a really strong piece. Had great characters, a great message, some real resolution, and it really said something. You know what this movie says? This movie says, drugs will mess you up, but they're a lot of fun. I don't know. A movie like this feels like it should have been reserved for people in their 20s, not people in their 30s. It's this kind of behavior that when you make a movie out of it, I don't find it as entertaining when these are people who really should be adults. There's a certain degree of growth with the characters. They try at the end to really kind of tie everybody up and give them a certain degree of heart. And that just gets tedious because once the night's over and the craziness stops, there is no development to the characters, so you really don't care what happens to them. I mean, it has some laughs in it. But if I want to see something that's completely bonkers and crazy and funny, I'll watch Harold and Kumar's Christmas movie, because that thing's funny, and I'm not a pothead. But that movie works as a all-night party movie. This one just, I mean, it's there. That's the best I can say. It's there, but it's a real step down from doing something that really was a rich, strong film, you know, something like 50-50. And then you get this movie that's just kind of like, well, there's Seth Rogen taking drugs. And this isn't my kind of movie. I'm probably not the target market for it. I mean, for what it is, it's fine. But ultimately, as a movie that's worth seeing, kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Oh, okay.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, we're going to be talking about The Hollow, a listener voicemail, the box office, and the home cinema roundup. Elizabeth Stokes' new romance novel, Five Nights in Vegas, is about meeting, getting married, and falling in love, in that order. Lexi Frost is a cocktail waitress in a Las Vegas casino. Nate Zimmerman is a marketing executive from back east. After a chance meeting on Nate's business trip, they wake up to discover they got married at an all-night wedding chapel. During their whirlwind attempt to undo their mistake, Lexi and Nate discover they might just be made for each other after all. Five Nights in Vegas by Elizabeth Stokes is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Finishing up the movie reviews, there's one more film I want to talk about. The Hollow. Parents move to the country in Ireland only to discover there is something in the woods that wants their baby.
He's in the forest again, is he? He's trespassing. It's dangerous for him.
They believe that the forest that you're trampling on belongs to the Hollow.
The Hollow.
Fairies, banshees, baby stealers.
So you a believer?
Mr. Hitchens, this is in London. Things here go bump in the night.
Stay here. Lock the door.
Adam?
Wait!
Wait, Adam! There's something back there!
If you trespass upon them, they'll trespass upon you.
This is a horror film, and it doesn't seem to be as sort of off-putting as a horror film as the Funhouse Massacre did last week, because that one took place on Halloween. It just felt weird opening 2 weeks after Halloween. This one's not a Halloween movie. It's just a horror movie. And it's a horror movie that just happens to come out in November. It's a very effective horror movie. And this is a great example. And I've said this before. If you really want to see the innovative stuff going on in horror, you need to go to video on demand, because that's actually where the best horror is. Yeah, if you got an independent theater or a smaller art house theater that's going to show this stuff, like in Columbus, Ohio, this is actually playing on the big screen. You can go see this, which is where I'm from, at the Gateway. But a lot of places, it's just not going to open, but you can get it online and watch it at home, and it's worth seeing. It's better than most of the horror films that you're going to see that are hitting the mainstream theaters. That's where the really innovative stuff is. You know, 30 years ago, when they had horror movies coming out, 30, 40 years ago, they'd hit the regular theaters because these movies would be like 1 or 2 weeks and they'd be done. Nowadays, to get a full theatrical release, it needs to have a big marketing campaign. And then if it doesn't make $30 million this opening weekend, or at all, it's considered a flop. They still are making these really weird, different, and non-mainstream horror films, but they're showing up on VOD services. This is where you can get this one. This is a creepy movie. And it feels like one of those nature gone wrong movies, stuff like Nature's Grave or Tourist Trap type thing. It's an effective film, and it's a very limited film. The locations are very, very few. A lot of it's shot in a single cabin or house out in the woods. But boy, is it effective. It is creepy. It has an explanation for the monsters. And it merges that whole nature attacking people with body horror and with a child in trouble. So it kind of has these three staples of horror movie delivery kind of all wrapped up into one, and it all works very organically. Absolutely worth seeing if you like scary films, if you like creepy movies. The Hollow, probably the best movie of this week. And that's sad, because I was so looking forward to 2015. And even the big ones, stuff like Avengers 2, was a little disappointing to me. There haven't been the hugely impressive big movies for me. And some of the most interesting stuff, the most innovative stuff I've seen, is coming out in the smaller release platforms. So it may not be a great year for blockbusters for me, but certainly for the limited independent stuff, especially in the horror genre, this is where it's at. So The Hollow totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about a listener voicemail. This comes from our good friend, Thomas from Seattle. And he has a little bit of a Star Wars question. Let's hear what he had to say.
Hi, Kevin. This is Thomas from Seattle, long time no see. Hey, I was wondering if Star Wars The Force Awakens is not great or even bad, will all of us heavy Star Wars fans, will we be able to admit that to ourselves? If it's bad, can we call a spade and say it's bad?
That's an interesting question. There's no way to really fully answer it with a definitive answer. Because look at what happened with Episode 1. Episode 1 is pretty much agreed upon by everybody, even fans and non-fans alike. It's probably the weakest of all six Star Wars movies. Even somebody like me, who still enjoys the prequels and will defend them and will watch them. And I love what they stood for, and I love how Star Wars was this modern version of serialized science fiction that you would get in the movie houses back in the 40s. But I'll be the first to admit, The Phantom Menace isn't the best Star Wars movie out there. But when it came out, it is of the prequels, it did the best because of the anticipation. And even people who didn't particularly like it, who thought Jar Jar Binks was dumb and were annoyed with Jake Lloyd as Anakin Skywalker, it still made a ton of money and it brought back the excitement and spectacle of Star Wars. Now, we've waited 10 years for a new Star Wars movie, which is not as long as we had to wait between Return of the Jedi and The Phantom Menace, but it's close. There's only 16 years between Jedi and Phantom Menace, and it's only been 10 years. So we've had to wait a while. And I think that there's going to be a lot of excitement about this. It's going to be hard to separate the emotion of seeing The Force Awakens and not get wrapped up in, unless it really kind of just is bad. I mean, if it's genuinely not a good film, it will be recognized as that. But if it's something that's just okay, but still hits all the beats that we want from Star Wars, which it's already doing in the trailers. I mean, you still got the music, you've got the design, you've got the weapons, you've got Han and Chewie back, you've got the stars back. So it's going to be hard not to get swept up into the hype. But I mean, if it's genuinely a crappy movie, I think people will call it for what it is. It's going to make tons of money either way. I saw a news report that it's already made $50 million in pre-sales. It's a month away. Well, it's just less than a month away. It opens in what, like 4 weeks? This is going to be a juggernaut in the box office, no matter what. But I think people, if it's not good, people will recognize it. Where it's going to have the questionable legacy is whether people immediately recognize it and if it's just okay. And then you're going to get people are going to hate it anyways. You're going to have people who are going to love it no matter what. Hope that answers your question. Thanks for the voicemail, Thomas. Let's move on and talk about the box office. Last week, was I correct? Was my prediction of $35 million for Spectre accurate? It was actually very close. It was just under $34 million. So I was right on the nose with this one. My Spectre predictions have been great. Even topping the weekend 2 weekends in a row and making $120-some million over 2 weekends, it's still only about half of what its budget is. Now, it's, I think, at like $500 million or more worldwide, so it's already made its budget back. Mockingjay is going to take a big chunk out of it this week. Peanuts movie came in second with 24, which is a great hold, actually. Love the Coopers was the highest grossing new movie with just over 8 million. The 33 with just over 6 million. And then My All American didn't even crack the top 10 with 1.3 and change. This weekend, what are things going to win? I'm going to say that The Hunger Games, you know, the last one made $120-some million, I think, its first weekend. I think this is probably good for, I'm going to say $115 million. I'm going to be a little bit conservative on this estimate because I think it's going to be front-loaded. I don't think that there's the mainstream excitement for this movie that there has been before. You got to remember that the first Hunger Games movies, the first two movies, made $150 million on in like a March release. These were huge numbers for the frame that they came in. So $115 million is still good for a movie like this that's overstayed its welcome. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the world-famous Home Cinema Roundup. I already talked a little bit about The Hobbit, The Battle of the Five Armies, mainly because I mentioned The Hobbit being split into three movies. This time it's the extended edition. And every single Lord of the Rings movies from the first three, and including The Hobbit films, have had an extended edition. This one is special because it's R-rated. And a lot of people said, hey, that's kind of interesting. I'd love to see an R-rated Hobbit movie. Well, you're seeing like 20 minutes of R-rated content edited in. They don't go and bloody up the rest of the film. But there's the scenes that they have, that they've added, are pretty graphic. Now, it's all CGI blood, but you can hardly complain about CGI blood when it's spurting out of the neck of a CGI ogre. I don't like digital blood when you've got something like The Expendables and they're shooting somebody and a real person is going blah, 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 and then you see digital blood. You got to have digital blood in a movie that's essentially an animated film. The extended edition is fun to watch because you get that R-rated content, and it's something different and something you've not seen, A. And B, it's neat because if you buy this, this is where you get the appendices. That's like 9 hours, like 9.5 hours of bonus content. It's three times as long as the film. So if you want to be a completist and you want to add this to your collection, I mean, you have something like between this and Lord of the Rings, you can start watching them and it'll take you a week just watching them straight to watch the entire Lord of the Rings and Hobbit series along with the appendices. It's for the fans, and it works. So I enjoyed it. I thought it was kind of cool. There's also the collected works of Hayao Miyazaki, which is, he's a great director, and he's got some great movies. If you haven't gotten them, you can get this full Blu-ray set. It's expensive, but totally worth checking out. The Man from U.N.C.L.E., which was okay, and Jimmy's Hall, which is also okay. Talked about that earlier this year. Then there's a couple smaller releases, Trash with Rooney Mara and Martin Sheen, and then Jeff Dunham, Unhinged in Hollywood, if you want to see a guy play with puppets. That's it for this week. When I come back next week, I'm going to be talking Turkey Day, and I'll be covering Creed, The Good Dinosaur, Victor Frankenstein, and The Danish Girl. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.